This is Maximilian Alvarez reporting for The Real News Network and Indies Times Magazine from the Real News Studio in Baltimore. Earlier this summer, I got to travel to Wisconsin as part of our special collaboration with Indies Times to investigate the changing political terrain in the Badger State. Along with reporting on rural Wisconsinites' fight against the factory farming industry, we spoke extensively with teachers and organizers around the state about the trajectory of the labor movement in Wisconsin, especially after the coordinated assault on workers and unions that turned Wisconsin into a right-to-work state and that stripped public sector workers of their collective bargaining rights with the passage of Act 10 under Republican Governor Scott Walker 10 years ago. In the decades since Act 10 passed, the landscape for workers' rights and organized labor has changed dramatically. But all hope is not lost. In this special series of reports, we'll be speaking with folks on the ground who are using the tools that they have to strengthen their communities and rebuild working class power in Wisconsin. And we're going to be kicking off this series with a conversation that I got to have with Maricela Aguilar Monroy, an undocumented educator and organizer who has spent most of her life in Milwaukee and who is working to strengthen the community that has provided a home for her so that it can continue to provide a home for others.
Hello, everyone. My name is Maricela Aguilar Monroy. I am a teacher from Milwaukee Public Schools here in Milwaukee. I teach high school. I'm a long time member. I've been living in Milwaukee for a very long time. I moved here when I was three. I've grown up here all of my life, and I am part of an undocumented mixed status family.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking time to do this. Really excited to get to talk to you about your work and, you know, about a lot of the other things that, you know, we are kind of investigating here in Wisconsin and, you know, what working people like yourself are going through, especially educators in the wake of, you know, game-changing legislation like Act 10 that really reshaped the landscape for educators and public sector workers around the state. Then soon after that, Wisconsin became a right-to-work state. You know, so there's a lot here, right? And, you know, I think that folks who are watching this have probably heard about these things, but they haven't really taken time to sit down and talk about, you know, what it looks like for workers like yourself, for people living here, and how it shapes your life and your work. So I want to talk to you about that, but honestly, I wanted to get to know a little more about you first and kind of how you came to be a teacher. So you said you moved to Milwaukee when you were three?
Yes, I did. So I was born in Mexico. My parents decided to move to the United States when I was really young. So this is obviously like in the wake of NAFTA. And so we lived in rural Mexico. I know there's like folks that I think are like, oh, Mexico's nice and there's cities. That's not where I grew up or where I was born. It was kind of like in the mountains in the middle of nowhere, very agrarian, you know, old school setup. And so there were obviously not a lot of opportunities there for my sister and I, so much so that we literally only had like one classroom school there for all of the kids. There was no middle school. You kind of had to travel about an hour and a half by car to get to the middle school. So, I mean, there was just no opportunity for us there. And so my parents decided to come to the United States. A lot of people always talk about, well, why didn't you do it the legal way? We did. We tried really, really hard. We applied for visas. We tried all of the legal avenues and were denied every step of the way. I think a lot of people miss the fact that there are no legal pathways for poor people to come into this country. And we were poor, and so we obviously were not provided that pathway. Still had no opportunity, so we still had to find a way to make a life. And so they decided to come into the country illegally. So that's how we entered. It was about 95. So my sister and I were both young. We lived in California for a hot second, and then we moved to Milwaukee. My aunt had told us there were a lot of industrial type jobs still here, which were great for my parents. And so that's why we decided to move here. And we've been here ever since.
I mean, it's really, I think, kind of important story for people to think about, right? It's because, like, we often, when we hear about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which you know, kind of became law in 1994, we hear about it from the American side.
Right.
Right. So, and from places like this, we're in the Rust Belt, right? You know, we're in the Midwest here in Milwaukee. The narrative that we hear, especially in recent kind of presidential elections, Bernie Sanders talked about this a lot. Donald Trump talked about this a lot. You know, we talk about how this free trade agreement really kind of accelerated the deindustrialization of places like where we're sitting right now. And those jobs going to places like Mexico and the kind of maquiladoras along the border and stuff like that. But we often don't hear about what it looks like on the other side, right? I guess could you talk a little bit about what NAFTA meant for you and your family so much that this was the kind of only viable option to make a life for
yeah.
you guys?
Yeah. So like I said, we were agrarian, but think about the tools and the systems set up in Mexico, which were pretty much its hand labor. So both of my families, paternal and maternal, were growing food by hand. And so to compete, once you open those trade borders, to compete with the agribusiness of the United States becomes impossible. Stuff that they were able to sell at the markets at a reasonable price and still be able to live lost pretty much all of its value, because the markets were being flooded with cheap produce from the United States because it was just so much easier to make here. And so its value was a bit lower. I remember a lot in my econ class where they talked about free trade and what that does. And they're like, well, there's some winners and losers, but in the end, the pie gets bigger. And there was never any like discussion about like who got access to this much bigger pie.
Right.
And it was not us, and it was not the people of Milwaukee who lost those industrialized jobs. It was the rich. They just got richer. And the rest of us just had to fight each other for crumbs and like figure out a way to live. And so, I couldn't make the connections when I took my econ classes, but now I make those connections, right? It's like, okay, we have a bigger pie, but we did not get it. Absolutely any access to it. It went to other people.
Yeah, that's the fine print, right? The pie gets bigger. Our access to it does not.
Like, who got the pie?
Yeah, I think that's really perfectly put. And so on your way to Milwaukee, then, you said you stopped off in California. That's where I'm from. Then y'all came here. You made a life because you said it was your tia who said that there were industrial jobs still here?
Yeah. So we lived with my tia first when we stopped by in California. I think it was right around Pete Wilson era. And so it was really difficult to live there. Right now you think of California like, dang, I should have stayed. But it was really hard during that time. My dad was being stopped constantly and being able to get his car out of the pound lot. And so it was just too expensive for us at the time. My tia made the suggestion. She had some relatives. I think it was her in-laws that were living here already. And they were like, there's a lot of factory jobs, lots of stuff available. And so we kind of packed up our stuff and moved over here. Pretty big change.
Pretty big change, yeah, especially in the winter.
Yeah, we moved in November, too. It was horrific.
Yeah. I want to go back.
Yeah, we immediately got off the plane. We were like, oh, God.
Yeah. That's how I felt when I first came to Chicago after living in Southern California my whole life. I was like, fuck this. I want to go back.
Yeah, Milwaukee's awesome, though. I think it's built a really close-knit Latino neighborhood. I think a lot of people appreciated. My neighbor's cousin recently moved over because he was in another town here in Wisconsin. And then he came to visit and he saw all of the stores that we have and the artwork and the music. And he, out of nowhere, just decided to move here.
That's great. I mean, hell, I'm sold. Like I was telling you before we started recording, I was like, this is a lot of really beautiful parts here.
Yeah, I think the Latino people of Milwaukee have really built this awesome community and this awesome home for us and our culture.
Hell yeah. Well, so I guess what was the kind of path from there to you eventually becoming a teacher?
Yeah. So I went to school actually like two blocks from here. It's really funny. I've lived on 22nd Street my whole life.
Oh, where?
I lived like four blocks down that way and then moved over here. And the school is like a block over. So I went to school there. It was a bilingual program. And at the time, I thought that that was normal. In the United States, I thought everyone had, like, bilingual programs and that you got to be bicultural and everything was fun. And and it's not. But that was my experience at Longfellow, a street over from where we are now. And I loved it. After that, I went to Walker Middle School. Doesn't exist anymore. Also MPS. And then I graduated from Hamilton High School. And throughout all of that, I think I just had like an exceptional experience. So much so that I got to get a full ride to Marquette University. And I started to get involved in politics. I'm undocumented. And so kind of that was my pathway into organizing, activism, and politics. Obviously, especially when I was graduating, I was kind of like, oh gosh, how do I figure this out? Or what am I supposed to do here?
Right.
And magically, things worked out for me because it's all luck. Like, when it comes to that, it really is a lot of luck. And it shouldn't be like that. Higher education should be something that you do your work and you should be able to afford it and do all of those things.
Right.
It's not like that. I was lucky and I made it. But I still wanted to kind of work towards helping other undocumented students get that opportunity that I was being given. And that was my start working with Voces de la Frontera here in Milwaukee. So we did a lot of organizing around in-state tuition for undocumented students here in Wisconsin. And then also for the DREAM Act is around 2010. So that's kind of where my activism and organizing started. And so I did that for a really long time. Obviously, you know, organizers get a little burnt out and you feel like it's not going much anywhere sometimes. So I was like, I think if I'm like in the classroom and if I have like a crew of students that have to listen to me, you know, I feel like I'm making a little bit more of a change. And so that was a little bit of the reasoning that I went into teaching. But I love working with young people. It's like working with the future.
Yeah, I mean, quite literally, yeah. Right? And and not only, you know, you as an educator really, yeah, kind of shaping the future of this country, but for it to be at the school that you went to in this neighborhood where you're also helping, you know, students who come from similar backgrounds, you're helping kind of provide that bilingual, multicultural kind of education. I mean, it's really incredible.
Yeah. And so I mentioned, like, I thought everyone had bilingual, bicultural education. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older where I was like, oh gosh, like, people don't have this around the country. And we have something really special here in Milwaukee. We have, I would say, one of the premier bilingual programs in the country. And so to be able to be a part of that and to help grow that and to solidify that within our city and our culture, I think that's really awesome. Important.
Well, I mean, because, you know, obviously, as we were talking about before this, like, don't get us wrong, Milwaukee, like the rest of America, has a lot of problems, right? Oh, has a lot of, absolutely. Especially deep set kind of racial and ethnic divisions. I mean, it's one of, if not the most segregated cities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, within that, like you said, there's still really important efforts going on to build community, to educate people, to build political power for working people,
yes.
Which is, you know, a big part of what we're talking about here today, right? Because you
yes.
said that your own path to activism, you know, through Voces was around 2010?
Yes.
So the next year was the Wisconsin Uprising. So I guess, where were you in all of that?
Yeah, so I just graduated high school. So it was my first couple of years in college. I had some really great teachers at my high school that I still kind of kept in contact with because they were just very supportive in my transition in a university. And so I remember kind of starting seeing on the news these things and seeing teachers whom I really appreciated being really involved in, like, this can happen. And I really wasn't well-versed in the bill or the like actual legislative impact it would have. But I could see the teachers whom I admired and who were really helpful in my own development bring this up as a really serious issue. So just off of that, I was like, okay, I'm in. Like, what do we need to do? And especially Voces not only being an immigrant rights organization, but also being a labor mm-hmm. rights organization, was very involved in supporting that effort. And so it was kind of coming at, from both angles in terms of like reasons why we needed to be active in that struggle. I remember one teacher in particular. Now, now we see each other at like our building representative meetings, which is very cool. But he would like give me updates like, oh, I think tomorrow, there's going to be a lot of teachers who are going to Madison and we need people to help with the buses. And so I would be waiting at like 5 a.m. to get the text of whether or not we need like bus chaperones or bus captains. That was mostly what we did as student organizers for buses. We were the bus captains, just making sure everyone was on the bus when we got there and when we left, teaching people chants, keeping track of the younger high schoolers, making sure they weren't going anywhere. And so that was kind of my activism in terms of Act 10. After that, we helped a little bit with the recall, which was kind of traumatic. But it was a very, I think, important time in our political development, being able to see our teachers kind of stand up in that way, knowing that it wasn't just for them, that it was for the future Maricelas and the future Citlaliques and the future all of us who needed the best educational services possible.
Could we, well, let's talk about that a little more because, like, you know, I'll be honest, like, you know, I mentioned to you that my dad, Jesus, you know, came over from Tijuana with his family when he was young. But he grew up conservative. He raised us conservative. My mom and my dad raised us conservative. And, you know, I was also raised in Orange County, California, which is like the heart of the Reagan Revolution.
Yeah, I was like, whoa.
So I grew up consumed by all of this anti-union culture. And I remember at one point when teachers at my high school were, I think, in bargaining, there was a dispute that I knew nothing about. And suddenly all of that anti-union stuff just kind of kicked in for me. All I heard was like, well, these teachers, you know, their responsibility is to their students. So if they're not going to work, they're hurting the students. It's mostly women in this profession, you know, like, so there's also a lot of kind of gender politics kind of playing out in that way. Like, oh, like you're the care that you put into this, your natural calling to care for students, like that should be compensation enough, right? There are always these weird ways that educators get kind of told not to. They get classified as non-workers in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think that when everything in Wisconsin was happening 10 years ago, even me watching it from afar, it was a really important kind of political education for myself to see what you were talking about, to be like, okay, why are all these teachers and why are all these public sector workers and all these people supporting them, why are they out there? Why is the biggest, like, mass protest in Wisconsin's history happening on my TV screen right now? What am I not getting about this? So I guess I wanted to ask you just like, if you could talk a little more about that experience of like learning what Act 10 meant through the people that you knew who were involved with it.
I think the simplest way that I've ever heard this explained to me is that teachers' working conditions or students' learning conditions. So the better the working conditions for a teacher, it's the better like learning conditions for all of their students. And that's just simple. And even now that I'm a teacher, I can tell you, like, I wish I had more time. I work really hard. I love all my students. I care for them deeply. Patience is not a given trait for everyone. It's a really active trait that you work on constantly, that there's a fairly heavy burden on you personally. Good lesson planning takes a lot of time. I wish I had 1-2 more hours of lesson planning so that I can provide the best lessons for my students. And so those are the things that teachers need to educate our students to the best of their abilities. I can be quite honest, I'm not teaching students to the best of my abilities. If I had more time, I would.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that, right? Because this intertwines with Act 10, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, Act 10, for those who don't know, I mean, it did an incredible amount of damage, not just to, you know, public sector teachers, but I mean public sector workers. Then, as we said, Wisconsin became a right-to-work state. Collective bargaining for public sector workers was more or less taken away. You know, pensions, the pension system was kind of totally redone. Workers took big hits here in the past 10 years, and that has obviously impacted the ways that people are able to do their jobs, not just like the ways that workers are able to organize in unions to defend themselves, to demand what they need, which a lot of unions are still having trouble doing. Union density in Wisconsin went down significantly over the past 10 years. More just trying to give some background context for people watching. But I wanted to kind of bring that to eye level and ask you a little more about that. Like, both in terms of how Act 10 has shaped your working life as a teacher, but also just, you know, the life of a teacher in America in general, being as overworked, not having the time that you need. Could you just, for people who are watching who don't know what that's like, could you, I guess, flesh that out a little
more? Yeah, I think my understanding, so Act 10, we couldn't bargain on anything other than wages after that. And so that's time, that's all of extracurriculars, that's extra pay. It's just a lot of stuff that we don't get to bargain on anymore. And so what that looks like is we just keep losing little bits over and over and over. And I'm going to go through what it's actually like on a daily. So you're supposed to teach 3 classes a day if you're a high school teacher, right? Sometimes it could be the same class, sometimes just 2 different subjects. That means you have to prepare an entire presentation for your students, practice it, have activities for them, set up any sort of breakouts in a way that your classroom management isn't going to fall apart, do all of that, implement all of that, and then grade everything. And you get about an hour sometimes to do that. For perhaps 1 or 2 classes. So,
I mean, talking every day of the week.
Right. And so I take work home every day. I cry about it, but I take it home. Because, you know, it's the best that I can do for my students. I teach English, so it's a lot of essays. It's a lot of writing. Students need that constant feedback. So all of that time, it was taken from us. And this is from talking to colleagues. I still have a pretty good scenario in my life. You know, elementary school teachers who have to teach all subject areas for kids all over the place in terms of their levels, in terms of special education, in terms of the scaffolding and help that they need. Like, when elementary teachers talk to me, I'm just like,
like, how are you still standing?
Right. And my neighbor, you know, she used to be a teacher, an elementary school teacher, and like, she just couldn't do it anymore because the asks that are made of teachers are insane. And, you know, and we're just supposed to do it out of the kindness of our heart.
Right.
And that's just not fair. Like, pay me.
Yeah.
Pay me for the kindness of my heart.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it really is like, I mean, you see this in a number of professions, right? I mean, I think it happens the worst to teachers, but I think also of like hospital workers, right? It's like the care work that's involved where, you know, it's kind of classified as this sort of noble profession where, as you said, you are shaping the future of the country, the future generations, and you take pride in that. That doesn't mean that you should be paid any less for it, right? In fact, that means that we should be investing more in it, but it puts all the responsibility on you to kind of like tell yourself, well, even if I'm not getting paid enough, even if my benefits have gone to shit, even if I'm getting more and more work piled onto me that I'm taking home and I'm having less and less time to lesson plan, the mission is enough to keep me going, right?
Yeah, it's pretty insane. And then whenever you kind of stand up and say like, no, then it kind of like gets flipped on you. It's like, well, why are you not being the best teacher you can be? There's so many discussions about achievement gaps. I think that's like a hip word right now in education. Let's close the achievement gap. Mm. You know how we could close the achievement gap? Giving teachers more time. That would be one of the biggest improvements to closing the achievement gap.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we're talking about achievement gaps, we're talking about having a class where you have students at so many different levels, especially in the bilingual program, right? We have a lot of newcomers who still are not fluent in English. We have a lot of bilingual students who require different levels of attention. And so giving teachers more time to differentiate and build kind of the supports that those students need in every lesson, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not like it's one thing and then it works for the whole year. In every lesson, you have to build those in for them. That's how you close the achievement gap. It's not like rocket science.
Right.
And then also providing a lot of more mental health services and support to parents. It's just all of these things that if you ask any teacher, it seems they'll give you their top three, and it's always the same top three, but we never get any of that.
Right. Well, I mean, like, in I guess the, what are the powers that be, whether you're talking to people in the district or you're trying to appeal to legislators, what is people's resistance to that? Like, if teachers are pointing people and saying, like, we'll give you better education if you give us, like, the ability to do our jobs, how do people say no to that? I mean, I know that they do, but I guess, like, what is the resistance that you tend to face?
All right. I'm not sure. I think, and this, maybe we could edit this out, because
we can free-balling
it. But, like, I think in capitalism, people are obsessed with work. Like, you have to work, and you have to show me that you're working, and you have to be tired all the time. I don't know why. It's like, why can't people do things to the best of their ability at leisure?
Well, I think that this is, I mean, it's something that I think about a lot, and I'm sure a lot of us do. Whatever we do as a profession, right, is just like, I can't remember the last time I did anything where I felt like I had all the time I needed on this. I did it to the standard I wanted to. I mean, I think I was a kid the last time that that happened. It just feels like part of being an adult in such a work-obsessed, puritanical, capitalist kind of et cetera, excited society is just learning to live with the fact that, yeah, you will never kind of be able to do your best because the conditions that you're working under kind of prevent you from doing that. And then when people kind of complain that the work is substandard, right, or that the teachers are burning out or what have you, it's just like, yeah, give us more time and support to do our jobs the right way. This is something that I feel like everyone in every industry has experienced in some way, shape, or fashion.
Right. I think if they were to agree to it, it would perhaps start showing kind of the tensions there, that people can have more time and they can do their job well in a relaxed way. Like, I don't have to go to school stressed every day. Mm-hmm. I don't have to. It actually makes me less efficient throughout the day.
But, to be more stressed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The more stressed you are, the less patience you have with the students. And so the more chill you are, the more patience you have, the kinder you can be, and the better you can support students. But again, it's a systemic failure. Like, it's, I think working people aren't meant to be, like, stressed and mentally abused under capitalism.
I mean, all evidence supports
that. Right, and they have to,
yeah,
in order to show that it's, like, working or efficient. And once you start, yeah, they can't say no.
No, they can't. I mean, like, and, you know, I wanted to kind of, because I don't want to keep you too long. I know that you actually have to go work soon. I wanted to ask, like, you know, understanding kind of all the barriers that have been put in place, all of the uphill battles that working people in general have to face, but also educators in Wisconsin like yourself have to face after Act 10, you know, which kind of became law 10 years ago. I wanted to kind of round out by focusing on, you know, how folks like you are, you know, rebuilding, right? You know, where you see signs of hope amongst your coworkers, amongst your students, in your community, right? I mean, there's a lot of failure to be kind of that we need to think about and discuss in the wake of Act 10, but there's also a lot of fight left, mm-hmm, in working people here. And I wanted to kind of focus on that to round things out.
Yeah, I think right-to-work legislation sometimes really does diminish certain public sector unions. And I think our teachers union was not the case. And so I'm super happy about that. We actually still have really high membership rate. And we've developed programs and structures that allow our members to not just, it's not like a service union where you just call and get your things figured out and that's it. Like, no, you also like put in work in your own building. And it's an expectation we have of our membership, you know, per ability and per your own personal life. But I think it is generally kind of an expectation in our union that you also have to like put work in. And we have a lot of really great organizers in our ranks. We've brought in a lot of great organizers, you know, similar paths like mine, who were community organizers before transition into education and now have some really great community organizing skills on like multiple fronts, not just immigration. It could have been in other sectors. And so we have a really strong union with a really strong emphasis on organizing your building and your own community. And so I think that has made us really strong. We've had a lot of wins recently. So we've had our paraprofessionals and CHAs finally are up to 15. We've had a lot of funding for art teachers. We know that art is a need for young people. It's not kind of like a fun thing that they get to have. It's something that they need in their education. And so we have a lot of art teachers who have recently been hired because of that funding win. And, you know, we've had steps and ladders be implemented again in our like a pay scale. So we've had a lot of wins and our union is really strong. And, you know, I wake up and that's like my big fuck you to Scott Walker. Just like, you thought, bitch.
So, oh, you thought.
Yeah, right. And it's like, here we are, one of the strongest. He still talks mad shit about the MTEA. But I think it's great to wake up every day and be part of the union Scott Walker couldn't kill.
Scott Walker could not kill. Yeah. No, I mean, hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, and for, I guess, like, folks outside of Milwaukee in the state, I mean, like, are there parts about the way that the union's set up or kind of parts of this sort of strategy, the building by building strategy, mm-hmm. that you think like have provided a more kind of durable way to kind of protect yourselves against the kind of implementations of Act 10, like the fact that unions have to recertify themselves every goddamn year, mm-hmm. you know, just to stay in existence, and that they have to do so with a majority of membership, not just a majority of the voters. Like, are there parts about, you know, the MTEA that I guess folks in other unions can learn from or build
yeah,
from?
I think we have a great communication structure and a great representation structure where the building representatives in each building are very much expected and tasked with communicating with their building and their membership. And I think that's done really well. And so that really strong communication structure allows for information, but then also for organizing. And I'm not a building representative this year, but I was last year. And everyone kind of gets into the rhythm of it. It's like recertification, and I got about 90% of my building to recertify in one day. So everyone's kind of got the motions down. And again, I think that structure that was, I don't know when it was set, but that communication and organizing structure that was set is rather efficient for us now. I think our union also does a good job at bringing those representatives together, either for required training or for relationship building. And that just makes us stronger. But yeah, I think that was pretty cool. We got recertified within a few days.
Again,
yeah.
Big fuck you to
yeah,
Scott
big
Walker.
Fuck you to Scott Walker.